This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Family planning goes back a very long way. In ancient times, couples used sea sponges, lemon halves, and crocodile dung to avoid pregnancy. Thankfully, science has improved the technology. Men and women have a range of safe and effective choices, but reproductive control is at the same time a very intimate and a very public issue. Today, an advisory panel to the Food and Drug Administration is hearing arguments over whether or not to make the so-called morning-after pill available over-the-counter. It's one part scientific debate. Is it healthy for women? One part social. Will it encourage risky behavior? And there's also a large part that's about business. Later in the program, another major piece of business, Boeing's decision about where to build its new jetliner and its competition with Europe's Airbus. But first, we'll catch up with the science, the business, and the debate over birth control. Join the conversation. If you remember contraceptive debates over the pill, for example, call and tell us your stories. And if you have questions about new technologies you've encountered or heard about, we want to hear from you, too. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is TOTN@npr.org. And joining us now from the FDA hearing at the Hilton in Gaithersburg, Maryland, is Dow Jones reporter Otisa Middleton. And thanks very much for stepping out of the hearing to join us.
Oh, well, thanks for having me.
Get us up to speed, if you would, on what is being decided there today. At what point in the process are we?
Well, so far, the company has presented their scientific data on Plan B, and they've presented they didn't have to present the efficacy data because it's already for sale for prescription. The FDA is already convinced that it works. They had to present information that consumers can understand the information and figure out how to use it themselves. So that happened this morning, and then the FDA presented its analysis. We just came back from lunch, and now the committee is going to discuss the information and vote. They're going to vote on whether they recommend that Plan B be switched from prescription to over-the-counter status this evening.
But that's not a final decision, and it goes to the Food and Drug Administration itself after that.
Right. The FDA will make the final decision, but this is a very important vote. When the FDA panel is convened, that means the FDA has specific questions for its outside panel of experts, and the FDA almost always follows their advice.
Any testimony from opposition people, witnesses today?
We've had lots of testimony today. So far, 42 public speakers have spoken, and I would say about twice as many are for the OT switch as are against it. So far, we've seen a lot of women's activist groups. We've seen some OBGYN doctor groups. We've seen some religious groups, but we've also had a reverend who is for the switch. So, like I said, out of the 42 speakers, twice are for the move OTC, and twice as many are for as against.
And OTC, of course, just a reminder, over the counter. What's been the tone of this discussion today?
Well, the FDA, when they first introduced the meeting, said that they want the panel to consider only the scientific data. They're just reviewing the science. Can a woman read the label, figure out if she indeed needs it, figure out if she shouldn't take it? If you're already pregnant, you shouldn't take it. If you're allergic to any of the ingredients, you shouldn't take it.
Mm-hmm.
And is the information presented in an easy enough fashion that a layperson could understand it, self-diagnose, and take it? And by self-diagnose, they mean had a unprotected sexual act within the last 72 hours.
Now, what does a decision to make a drug available over-the-counter mean for its future? I mean, it would be much more widely available to women, right?
Well, especially in the case of this, because there's such a short time window, it has to be used within 3 days, within 72 hours to be effective. And in fact, it's twice as much effective if it's used within the first 24 hours. So the company said that they want women to use it as soon as possible, as soon as possible. So that's why they want it over the counter. So although this particular drug has been on the market since 1999, they said they're not getting widespread use because also pharmacies don't always have it in stock. And because you need a prescription, a woman would have to call in or visit a doctor to get a prescription. And then if the pharmacy doesn't have it in stock, these things will delay the time to getting the medicine in that 72-hour span.
Now, how does this work, this Plan B pill?
Well, that is also part of the debate. Sometimes it's hard to find out the exact mechanism of action for a drug, exactly how it works in your body.
Mm-hmm.
But the company has said that it works like the birth control pill and that it prevents ovulation. So with Plan B, does not contain estrogen. It contains an artificial progestin only. There is another morning after pill that's also prescription called Preven mm-hmm. by Gynetics that is estrogen and progestin. And what Plan B does is the company says it stops ovulation. The debate is that it may stop fertilization or may stop implantation mm-hmm. after fertilization, which would make it a very early stage abortion. So that has been some of the debate from the public speakers, but not from the FDA and the company. The FDA and the company says they believe the mechanism is that it prevents the ovulation.
Now, you mentioned the word abortion, and that all immediately raises yet another level of political discussion. But is that, you say that the hearing today has been restricted to scientific evidence, and obviously this is a very emotional issue for a lot of people.
Right. The FDA is only concerned with the science, and they say this time and again at all meetings that they're going to discuss the scientific data because they can't take into account all the other issues, whether they're moral or religious. They're just looking at the science. Does it work? And is it safe?
Now, FDA staffers took a step yesterday of declaring their support for the over-the-counter request even before the hearing. That seems a little unusual.
Well, what happens is during the meetings, the FDA does present their view because they're asking their outside experts to weigh in as well. So they want the company to present, then the FDA presents. But in the past year and a half, the FDA has posted on its website the day before what its presentation will be. So that's actually not unusual. But because this could be a controversial issue, there are a lot more people looking at it.
I see. Otisa Middleton, we'll let you get back to the hearing and get back to your job. We appreciate your stepping out to speak with us.
Well, thanks a lot.
Otisa Middleton covers the Food and Drug Administration for Dow Jones. She joined us from the FDA's open hearing at the Hilton Hotel in Gaithersburg, Maryland. Today's hearing on the Morning After Pill echoes past fights over other contraceptive technologies like RU486 and Norplant. Throughout American history, birth control has sparked social debate at the same time that it's fostered entrepreneurial innovation. Andrea Tone wrote about these dueling forces in her book, Devices and Desires, A History of Contraceptives in America. She joins us now from her office at the Georgia Institute of Technology in Atlanta, Georgia. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
One part of this discussion today, I guess, is about business, and how does today's discussion at the FDA fit into that?
Well, emergency contraception has had a very long and interesting history, but the commercialization of emergency contraception kits like Plan B and Preven has been much more recent. It may interest listeners to know that it was actually veterinarians, not OBGYNs, who were using postcoital estrogens in dogs and horses back in the 20s and 30s to prevent them from becoming pregnant if their owners didn't want them to. And then throughout the 60s and 70s and 80s, before the FDA approved a number of oral contraceptives for emergency contraception in 1997, a variety of different compounds were used in the United States, including perhaps most controversially DES, during the late 1960s and early 1970s. It's only in 1999, as your previous speaker mentioned, that the FDA approved Plan B as a unique kit for emergency contraception. So prior to that time, a woman could get any number of brands of oral contraceptives to be used as emergency contraception. But this kind of unique phase in the history of the birth control business doesn't really take off until 1999.
Now, the morning after pill, as I understand it, contains higher doses of drugs found in birth control pills that are out there right now. Why would it attract so much controversy?
It's a good question. I think there are different camps who have arrayed themselves against the use of morning after pill or preferably emergency contraception, because it's important to remind people that you don't have to wait until the morning after you have sex to take it. I think it's controversial because there are people who confuse emergency contraception with abortifacients because they literally do not understand the difference in nomenclature between RU486 and the morning after pill. You know, these are students I teach. These are people on the street. These are even pharmacists, people who have a lot of background in science but don't realize that these are two distinct technologies that have two very different outcomes. I think also there is some concern among those who believe that life begins at the moment of conception, that the morning after pill is a form of abortion. The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and most professionals and medical people define pregnancy differently. They see it as a state that begins when a pre-embryo completes implantation into the lining of the uterus. So most people, people who've really studied the science of this, wouldn't see it as controversial, but someone having a different moral or religious background might feel that this transgresses their own understanding of reproductive ethics. But I think also, interestingly, we see in this debate some people in the feminist health community who worry that the long-term effects of repeat use of emergency contraception haven't been well studied, and that there might be dangers along the horizon, around the corner, that we just don't know about. And so to make this an over-the-counter drug runs the risk of exposing women to, as you say, a very high concentration of hormones whose long-term effects just aren't known at this point.
Our phone number, if you'd like to join the conversation, is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And Karen joins us on the line from Walnut Creek, California.
Hi, I'm glad you're taking my call. I have experience using Plan B, and I wanted to share that and some of my thoughts and experiences trying to get it. I am allergic to other forms of birth control, and so I have to use condoms and the old-fashioned rhythm method, which I know a lot of religious groups recommend. But the fact of the matter is that as careful as my partner and I can be, that doesn't always work, and on rare occasions, condoms break. And I resent the implications of some that the Plan B promotes promiscuity or that people who have to use it are promiscuous in some way. And I really feel it needs to be either over-the-counter, available over-the-counter, or that the medical community needs better training to take the need for emergency contraceptive seriously. I recently needed to use it and was under the impression that it was widely available over-the-counter in California and had a surprisingly difficult time finding it. Some of the major drug chains, such as Long's Drugs, a couple of their pharmacies carried it, but several of them didn't, and it was really like playing, you know, find the needle in the haystack to find a place I could get it, and I did pursue getting a doctor's appointment for it, and I had a really difficult time getting an appointment with my physician so that I could get a prescription.
In the limited window of time when it's effective.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, it's really serious because not everyone, you know, for financial reasons or for health reasons, is in a position to carry a pregnancy. And not that, you know, people are promiscuous or sleeping around, but occasionally things break. This is an emergency situation.
Karen, you've raised a number of interesting points. We'll try to address them after we come back from a break. We've got to go away, but we wanted to thank you very much for the call. We appreciate it. Karen calling us from Walnut Creek, California. More of your calls when we come back from a break. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. We're talking about the debate which surrounds each new development in contraceptive technology. You remember the introduction of the pill? I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing the future and the history of birth control. You're invited to join us. 800-989-8255. The email address is totn@npr.org. Our guest is Andrea Tone. She's the author of Devices and Desires, A History of Contraceptives in America. And Andrea, referring back to Karen's call before the break, how much of the controversy over the morning after pill do you think is about some of the issues that she was talking about, the issues that some people regard this as a promotion of promiscuity or could allow promiscuity?
Well, I think that is definitely a core part of the opposition, and it simply reflects a longstanding fear in American culture that dates at least as far back as the Victorian era to this sense that the very availability of contraceptives, be it the morning after pill or condoms or IUDs, will increase promiscuity, which kind of suggests a crude technological determinism that if you put a condom in front of somebody's face, that's going to, you know, make their passions go wild and encourage them to have sex. It is the reason why Congress criminalized birth control back in the 1870s. It's their political response to the reality of a very visible contraceptive market. But, you know, we see this same fear reflected in the refusal of some public school districts to hand out condoms in the classroom. Some people say that's just a prudent public health measure. Others see it as an inducement to promiscuity. And it was certainly a huge issue when the pill came out in 1960. A lot of people thought that this would unleash a kind of Pandora's box female sexuality effect.
Contraceptive debate today takes place on the sharpest edges of scientific research, but the history of reproductive control stretches back further than you might think. Some of the oldest contraceptive advice comes from a papyrus scroll dated to 1550 BC, which describes a recipe for a salve made of acacia seeds, dates, and honey. Crocodile dung suppositories were also popular in Egypt 3,000 years ago, and these ancient techniques may actually have been somewhat effective. Both raise acid levels, which is the theory behind modern spermicides. The same cannot be said, however, for fumigation techniques used in ancient India. That prophylactic mainstay, the condom, got its name in the 1600s from a doctor condom who was said to have invented it during the reign of Charles II. Its modern mass-produced incarnation dates to the mid-19th century when Charles Goodyear vulcanized rubber. Intrauterine devices are mentioned as early as the turn of the last century. A 1909 article described IUDs made out of dried silkworm gut. All of this goes a long way towards making the shots, patches, and rings of today seem a little less bizarre. And Andrea Tone, as you mentioned, contraception has had quite a checkered legal history in the United States. Can you give us a quick timeline?
Sure. In 1873, Congress, for the first time, criminalizes the birth control business, making it a crime to distribute birth control across state lines or to advertise it in flyers or to mention it in letters that were used in the post office. And shortly after 1873, states passed laws known as mini-Comstock Acts, which in some cases went so far as to criminalize the use of birth control in the privacy of the bedroom. And to let you know how long-lasting some of these legal prohibitions were, it wasn't until 1965 when the Supreme Court handed down its landmark decision in Griswold versus Connecticut, that the 1879 law in that state, which had made it a crime for married people to use birth control in their bedrooms, was overturned. So, you know, phenomenally, as recently as 1965, if you were a married woman wanting to get on the pill, which at the time was the most popular form of birth control in the country, you were forbidden under state law to get a prescription from your doctor.
Now, have the arguments for and against contraceptive innovation always been the same, or have they evolved over time? You mentioned the argument about promiscuity seems to be pretty persistent.
The argument about promiscuity has been persistent, but I also think it's taken a gendered edge. And it's interesting when we look at what forms of contraceptive technologies have been the first to have these legal sanctions lifted. It was the condom back in the late 19-teens, and it was done so as a public health measure. In other words, people didn't really care whether women were getting pregnant or not pregnant because of the availability of condoms, what they were most worried about was the transmission of sexually transmitted diseases. Fast forward to the pill, the controversy in the late 1950s and 1960 when the FDA actually approved oral contraceptives for contraceptive use was that this might create a whole new generation of selfish career women who wouldn't care about their primary responsibility in life, which was to perpetuate the species and be good stay-at-home mothers, even though the reality was that the birth control rate had been falling steadily since 1957, well before the introduction of the pill. People also said, you know, unleash the pill and you'll unleash premarital sex and promiscuity. And again, the reality was quite different. The highest point in American history for teenage pregnancy rates was the 1950s. What happened, of course, was that women and men were having sex. They've always had sex. But when they got pregnant, as they often did, they got married, or they were sequestered in maternity homes and they were forced to give up their children for adoption. So I think a lot of the political hyperbole is based on a real lack of awareness of the history of sexuality.
We also tend to think of, you know, one new technology after another. Have there been various techniques, various kinds of contraception that have been introduced and failed?
Introduced and failed. Yes. I mean, there have been technologies throughout world history that haven't made it, at least by commercial standards. We can think of the reality condom as an interesting case. It was introduced as the female condom. It was introduced in the United States in the 1990s, and it hasn't done very well relative to its popularity in other countries. And there are a whole host of explanations as to why that might be. Certainly it's expensive, and people using it have reported discomfort. The sponge was taken off the U.S. market years ago, although it's poised to make a comeback and is available in countries like Canada. So there have been methods that have failed to create a niche market, but that doesn't necessarily correlate to lack of safety or lack of efficacy.
Joining us now is Dr. Robert Hatcher. He's across town in Atlanta. He's a professor of obstetrics and gynecology at Emory University, the author of several medical textbooks, including Contraceptive Technology and Managing Contraception. And Dr. Hatcher, thanks very much for being with us today.
Nice to be with you.
This Plan B is just one of a number of new contraceptive technologies in the news. Hotly debated is a Seasonal. I'm not sure how to pronounce it.
Seasonal.
It's not the drug's function as a birth control, though, that's generating the controversy. Tell us a little bit about it.
No, as a matter of fact, it is a formulation like the pill Lovoral, which is actually the most common formulation used anywhere in the world. There are probably 80 or 100 brands throughout the world of exactly the same formulation. What's controversial is that it's taken for 84 days in a row, and then there's 7 days off. That's 91 days, or a fourth of a year. So every season, a woman will have a pill. However, there are a lot of contraceptives now that are beginning to move in the direction of women not having a period at all. And indeed, one of the ways Seasonal will be taken is that it will be taken for 84 days consecutively, and then there will be no break of 7 days. They'll start right off on a new package. And so a woman may, in this way, take pills for 6 months to a year and not have periods at all. And this is already being done with many, many other birth control pills, so that I think we're going to see this happen with birth control pills. It's already happening with the injection. If a person takes Depo-Provera injections every 3 months, by the end of 5 years, 80% of women are bleeding not at all, and by the end of a year, about 50% of people don't bleed. And the new IUD, called the Marina IUD, is an IUD that gives off progesterone, and about 20% of people at the end of a year don't bleed at all. So this is a big trend toward women having much lighter or no bleeding at all and using their hormonal contraceptive continuously.
We've got a lot of telephone calls, people calling in about Plan B and the morning after pill and other forms of contraception. So let's get to it, and let's begin with Bridget, who's with us from Kansas City.
Hi. I was just wondering, if you consider making Plan B over-the-counter, why isn't the birth control over-the-counter?
I'm sorry.
The birth control pill.
Which is now prescribed?
Yes.
Okay. Dr. Hatcher?
Well, many people are in favor of it being available over the counter. In fact, I write this book, Contraceptive Technology, which is a pretty standard textbook, and we sort of poll the authors periodically, and all seven of us are in favor of over-the-counter birth control pills. In fact, we all consider ourselves pretty ardent feminists, I might say. And in most of the world, the birth control pill is available over the counter. However, it is more dangerous than Plan B, and there are more serious complications. There are virtually no serious complications from Plan B. It's a progestin-only contraceptive, so that you have to be a little bit careful, and it becomes a question of risks and benefits. And the question, of course, remains in everyone's minds is whether or not it would be possible to adequately warn people so that the people who should not take birth control pills do not take them if it's available over the counter.
Andrea Tone, though, from our discussion with the reporter Otisa Middleton at the FDA hearing earlier, though, I understand the urgency for making it over the counter was to make it widely available to women in the relatively brief window of time when it's effective.
Right, and that's really important. As the previous speaker said, we want to make sure that women have the opportunity to get this pill as soon as possible, as soon as they've had unprotected intercourse. There is a very short window of time, and all the studies show that the quicker you begin to take Plan B, the more likely it is to be effective. You know, something else that needs to be added to any thinking about the business dimension to this, as I believe Karen stated when she called in, is that it is by no means easy to walk into any pharmacy in the United States and get this. Walmart decided in 1999 not to carry emergency contraception, and that means that in communities where Walmart might be the only supplier of drugs, women are going to be denied access to it. So it's important to make this product more accessible to women in a variety of ways.
Bridget, did we get you to your question?
Yes, I think you did.
Thanks very much. All right, let's go now to Tim, and Tim's with us from San Francisco.
Yes, can one of the speakers clarify for the layman the difference between how exactly RU486 works versus, say, Plan B, which is a progestin-only pill?
Dr. Hatcher?
Yeah, well, RU486 is a progestin antagonist, and it's exactly the opposite, actually. It prevents progesterone from attaching to the cells in the lining of the uterus, and progesterone must have a stimulatory effect on the lining of the uterus for pregnancy to continue. The progestin-only pill called Plan B is a high dose of a progestin, and it causes some thickening of cervical mucus and has effects if a person hasn't yet ovulated on ovulation. And if a person has ovulated and egg and sperm get together, it has effects on the lining of the uterus so that implantation can't occur. So that completely opposite, really. I never really thought of it that way, but they're entirely opposite methods of action.
Neil, can I weigh in here?
I do have to say that you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And go ahead, please, Andrea Tone.
I mean, one of the other things to point out, too, is that, and Dr. Hatcher can correct me if I'm wrong, if you are pregnant, the morning after pill will not impede the development of pregnancy. So when we think about an abortifacient, we think about it as something that terminates pregnancy. What's important to keep in mind with emergency contraception is it doesn't work that way. Once a woman is pregnant, even if she were to take Plan B, she would remain pregnant.
Tim, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And here's an email question we have from Robin Carpenter in Hanover, New Hampshire. Your guest, Andrea Tone, refers to the longstanding fear, going back to Victorian times, that contraception would lead to promiscuity. She's correct in that, but her implication seems to be that this fear is both ageless and groundless. If there is any one social development that is absolutely incontrovertible, it must be that the advent of the pill in 1960 did indeed lead to a mushrooming promiscuity, as evidenced in STD epidemics, pregnancies, and throughout our entire social life. Your guest may well approve of such liberty and promiscuity, but surely she cannot deny it is there.
Well, I don't think there's any evidence to substantiate this person's point. As I mentioned in my commentary earlier, we know that birth rates have been falling since 1957. We know from the Kinsey Report on Sexual Behavior in the Human Female, which was published in 1953, that there were already high rates of premarital intercourse among women. I mean, that's not to say the pill wasn't revolutionary, but I don't think we can put all of the blame on larger social forces that come after the pill on the single technology.
Let's go now to Diego, and Diego's with us from St. Louis.
Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, my first question was just answered about does the pill, does the morning after pill affect implantation, which apparently it does. So then to me, to say that it does not, that it is not more efficient, it seems like it does so only, it depends on when you define when pregnancy begins. If a pregnancy starts when, just when you have the fertilized egg, as some, many people do define it that way, then it does seem it does end a pregnancy. Anyway, that's just my comment. Thank you very much.
Okay, Diego, thanks very much. And Dr. Hatcher, is this, are we debating science here or philosophy, or both?
Well, we're really debating philosophy. In fact, I heard it once said, and I don't mean to sound sacrilegious at all, I'm actually fairly religious, and someone put a note in front of me. Excuse me.
That's all right.
It's been said that if that's the way the morning after pill works, then God is the world's leading abortifacient provider of abortions, because a good 30% of pregnancies where egg and sperm get together are miscarried. I mean, this is a very common phenomenon, and so, but the person
doesn't
is
resolve the philosophical. It doesn't resolve the philosophical debate.
No,
a question
it doesn't resolve it. And all I can say is that the definition, whether you're talking about the International Association of Nurse Midwives, OBGYNs, the World Health Organization, or public health agencies in this country, they all define pregnancy as that state which occurs after implantation has occurred. And that's just a definition. But, you know, that means I can't argue with someone who wants to define it differently.
We're speaking with Dr. Robert Hatcher, the author of many books, including Contraceptive Technology, and with Andrea Tone, whose book is Devices and Desires, A History of Contraceptives in America. When we come back from a short break, we'll take more of your calls. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK, and our email address is totn@npr.org. And we'll also bring you an update on a new the Rhythm Method as getting in a high-tech update. We'll bring you news about that when we come back from the break. Please excuse my mumbling my words. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Today we're discussing developments in contraceptive technology. If you have questions about what's on the market or what may be coming, join the conversation. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK, and the email address is totn@npr.org. Our guest is Dr. Robert Hatcher. He's the author of textbooks including Contraceptive Technology and Managing Contraception. And we have to say goodbye to Andrea Tone. She's the author of Devices and Desires, A History of Contraceptives Contraceptives in America, professor in the School of History, Technology, and Society at Georgia Tech, and we reached her at her office today. We thank her very much for her time. Options with hormonal birth control continue to increase. Many women, for personal or religious reasons, seek out other methods of birth control. One of the most time-honored is the rhythm method. Predict your fertile days, avoid sex during them, and prevent pregnancy. Simple as that, except that one step can be pretty complicated. Georgetown University's Institute for Reproductive Health has given the old technique a computer-aided update. And joining us now from the JP Palace Hotel in Agra, India, is Victoria Jennings. She's director of the Institute, and thanks very much for staying up to speak with us.
Well, thank you very much for having me on the show.
Tell us about the standard days method. How does it work?
Well, the standard days method is, as you suggest, a very simple, natural method of family planning. Essentially, the standard days method identifies days 8 through 19 of the woman's menstrual cycle as the days when pregnancy is likely, with pregnancy being very unlikely on any other day of the cycle. The method works very well for women with menstrual cycles between 26 and 32 days long. About 80% of cycles are within that range.
Now, I understand you've come up with a device, a system of beads that can help people keep track.
That's right. We developed it at Georgetown University. We developed the standard days method, and the testing that we did when we tested the effectiveness of the method in helping a woman identify her fertile days and avoid pregnancy on those days, avoid intercourse on those days to avoid pregnancy,
mm-hmm.
We developed cycle beads, which are a color-coded string of beads that help a woman know where she is in her cycle. They help her identify whether that day is a day that she's likely to get pregnant or not. And they also help her know whether her cycle is between 26 and 32 days long.
And what's the success rate if you use them?
The success rate is actually quite high if the method is used correctly. And because cycle beads are so easy to use, most women are able to use it correctly. The success rate, it's about 95% effective when used correctly.
And the key to it is there are still 12 days or so per cycle when you either have to use something else or not have sex at all.
Absolutely, that's right.
Is interest increasing?
Yes, it is. We began this method actually as part of our funding at the Institute for Reproductive Health, which we received from the United States Agency for International Development, with the idea that women in other countries would be interested in this method. But what we found since it became available just about a year ago in the United States is a real increasing interest in the U.S. as well. We're finding, for example, this method is now being offered by Planned Parenthoods. It's being offered by an increasing number of private providers. Cycle beads are now available in a number of pharmacies. They're available in a number of Whole Foods stores, Earth Fair. They're available over the Internet at cyclebeads.com. So we're finding a lot of interest by healthcare providers as well as by women themselves in this method.
Victoria Jennings directs the Georgetown University Institute for Reproductive Health. She was with us from the JP Palace Hotel in Agra, India. I think you're there for a conference, but have you had a chance to see the Taj Mahal?
I'm going to see the Taj Mahal tomorrow, thank you. Yes, I have been here at a conference on expanding contraceptive choice, which I think Dr. Hatcher would agree this is really what this is all about.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much for taking the time to stay up with us and speak with us tonight. Have a great time tomorrow.
Thank you very much.
Victoria Jennings of Georgetown University. Let's go back to the phones and Dr. Hatcher. And this is Patrick. And Patrick's with us on the line from San Jose, California.
Hi, Neil. Just wanted to make a quick comment about the actual availability of this film now being over the counter. One of the issues I think it might create is that as a physician, I know perhaps not a whole lot of time is spent on giving advice than actually prescribing, but nevertheless, even if a patient comes in many times in a month, for example, I've had cases where an 18-year-old patient came in three times in 1 month to request this sort of morning after pill, it creates an opportunity for me as a physician to take my hat off for saying actually give advice to the patient that this is in no way protective against sexually transmitted disease or anything in that nature. And obviously the recurrence of use of this medication will obviously not be something that's recommended at all. By providing this tablet over the counter, we're pretty much cutting down on the amount of advice that the physician have or the opportunity for advice on our behalf, and I think it pretty much, now I realize the tablet's available over the internet as well, with most physicians actually prescribe it without even seeing the patient, which I think is absolutely unethical. But I just wanted to make comments that, and see what Dr. Hatcher thought about that as well.
Dr. Hatcher?
Well, I think that there's some truth in that, for sure. In many instances, the pharmacist is giving good information to people with exactly the same message. And, you know, it's curious that the nature of bad habits is people do them more than once. And you may be talking about eating, drinking, whatever it is, not having any exercise. Bad habits happen over and over again. And therefore, one of the truths is that people have unprotected intercourse repeatedly, and that's very, very unfortunate. And being in that business for my entire professional career, I see the consequences of it and always want to encourage people to use contraceptives consistently and correctly. But people make mistakes, and they make them more than once. So I would say, yeah, I agree. We want them to use more effective contraceptives, but they may need to use an emergency contraceptive more than once. The second point, however, is that sometimes pharmacists give more thoughtful and considered advice than doctors. And that's a sad fact, I guess, that sometimes we don't do a very good job of talking to people. And so I want to encourage all doctors and pharmacists to handle the subject of emergency contraceptives as exactly as our last caller. I didn't get his last, Patrick.
Patrick, yes. Yeah.
Patrick what?
Patrick.
Yeah, I didn't get and exactly as Patrick suggested, that it should be used as an opportunity to get into more effective, longer-range contraception.
And we just have a few seconds left with you, but an interesting question from Kathy in San Antonio on email. For a woman who only has sex occasionally, would it be safer to use the morning-after pill than only when needed, rather than stay on the traditional birth control pill for extended periods of time?
That is a very interesting question, and the fact is that if a person is only having intercourse once or twice or three times a year, and she has emergency contraception available, and she takes it within an hour of unprotected sex, the failure rate for that is about 0.14%, or one in 700 acts of intercourse. It's really very, very low. And so it's a very, and since it's completely safe, it is a possible approach. But this implies having it available in your pocketbook or on your, at home, and you take it right away.
Thank you very much for being with us today.
It was a pleasure being with you. You guys do a great job.
I appreciate it. Dr. Robert Hatcher is the author of Contraceptive Technology and Managing Contraception. He joined us from Emory's Grady Hospital in Atlanta, Georgia, where he teaches obstetrics and gynecology.